So that's a little bit about the far-reaching attitude of patience, the Bodhisattva's practice of patience. Okay, so the patience of not retaliating, patience of bearing suffering, and the patience of practicing the Dharma. So I think what I'll do right now is instead of going on to practice, to talk about the far-reaching attitude of joyous effort, which, as I said at the beginning, falls under this thing of to bear the unbearable, I think because time is going, I'll open it to questions right now, and then you can have a little little bit of discussion or questions about what's on your mind based on this. Yes. Okay, so not how do we do that, but why do we do that? Why do we make ourselves a victim? Because we're under the control of ignorance. And somehow, in the midst of all our confusion, we think that making ourselves into a victim will make us happy. Okay? Because the way the ignorance thinks is, well, if I'm a victim, then there's nothing I can do to change my situation. So I have no responsibility. So don't blame me for my situation. See, it's a way, making ourselves into a victim is a way to get out of not accepting responsibility. Okay? And so for that part of us that doesn't want to be responsible, that likes to be lazy, that doesn't want to make an effort to change our situation, then making ourselves into a victim is a good way to do it. Because, hey, it's the other person's fault. There's nothing I can do. They have to change. Nothing I can do. I'm a victim. So what a great rationale for being lazy. Yeah? So in our confusion, you know, when we want to be lazy, then this is how we make it happen. We dream up this kind of way of conceiving the situation. And in the process, we disempower ourselves. Okay? But when we really accept responsibility for things, then there's a way to go ahead. Now, somebody's going to say, well, what about a little child, an innocent child, who is abused in one way or another and grows up with a victim mentality? Isn't that child a victim? Okay. When that child is a child, they don't have the mentality to be able to see the situation very clearly. They just are conditioned by the way the adults around them teach them to be. And so that child is probably going to be conditioned to feel that they're a victim because they don't, you know, the mind is very unformed at that time. Okay, but if you're older and if you have some knowledge of Dharma, okay, so this really depends on having some knowledge of Dharma. It doesn't work for everybody. But if you have some knowledge of Dharma, then you can say, oh, why did I have that horrible experience when I was young? It was because I created negative karma in my previous lives. So rather than hate the people who did this to me when I was young, I'm going to, you know, really start purifying my negative karma, because if I don't, I'm going to have more experiences like this one that I had when I was a child. Now, that might seem really like too much, like, wow, how could somebody ever do that? Well, I do prison work, and some of the inmates that I work with are really quite exceptional. And there's one young man in his mid-20s who's in prison for life for something he did when he was 16. And he wrote to me about how he was brought up as a child, and it was like a horror story, you know, when he talked about his family and what went on in his family and the beatings and the this and the that and the abuse and so on. And if anybody had had some reason to feel sorry for themselves and feel themselves as a victim, he would have been a good candidate because of what he experienced as a kid. But he was really changing in prison and really accepting responsibility for his actions. And, you know, saying, look, I went through all of that because of the negative karma I created in my past life. And that's what got me here in this situation, and I'm experiencing that now. And then he talks about, you know, he really appreciates the value of a precious human life. So even though he's locked in a maximum security prison, he really has a sense of how precious his human life is, with the possibility to practice the Dharma. And so as a result, he's really doing quite well, and his mind is very alert and vibrant, and, you know, he's stopped drugs, and he's stopped drinking, and he's learning Tibetan, and, you know, reading the Dharma, and doing all sorts of good programs. So the question was, in some countries, for example, the U.S., when there's capital punishment cases, when they execute somebody, then the family of the victim is allowed to attend the execution. And sometimes those people have a very strong sense of, oh, now justice is being done. Okay. You know, my dear one got killed, and I'm going to feel better now when they kill the killer. You know, I mean, a lot of people talk like that. I mean, it's one thing about my country I don't like very much, is that there's this very vengeful attitude. And people may talk like that, but I don't think rejoicing at another person's death makes you any happier. You know, when people may say all this stuff, oh, blah, 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 you know, an eye for an eye, and we got this guy because he killed my loved one. But when you go home at night and you lie in bed alone, because we only live with ourselves, really, do we feel good about ourselves after we rejoice at somebody else's misery? I don't think so. I don't think so. And, you know, rejoicing at somebody else's misery just doesn't, you know, we lose our own self-respect when we do that. And also it doesn't bring our loved one back to life. Our loved one's still dead. And now another family is grieving because the murderer was killed. So I don't advocate capital punishment. Yeah. Also because I've worked with too many people in prison, and I see them as human beings. And I think what allows there to be capital punishment is when we make a human being into an object. Yeah. But a human being is never an object. Human being is always a living person with feelings. So, and life is life, and as long as people are alive, there's the potential for change. So to take life, especially human life, I think is quite tragic. Yeah, regardless of what that person has done before. Now, as for the example of that I just told you. Yeah. Okay, so she's asking about the words mind and emotion, because mind sounds very intellectual and emotion seems as if it's just a reaction to something that happened. Actually, the way I'm using mind, the word mind, is as a translation of the Sanskrit word or the Pali word citta, okay? And that doesn't mean mind in the sense of intellect. It's more, it has more the connotation of mind and heart. In other words, that part of us that is conscious, that that is cognitive, that is aware. Some aspects of mind-heart may be conceptual or intellectual. Other aspects may be emotional. Okay? But they all fall under this big over broad category of mind or consciousness. What's very interesting is when you start to study Buddhist psychology is to discover that emotions are conceptual. Because we often feel that emotions are just gut reactions, you know, totally non-conceptual. Somebody criticizes me, I get angry. Yeah? Something looks beautiful, I've got to have it. As if, yeah? As if there's no space between the object or the incident and our reaction to it. You know, we often feel as, you know, here's this object and there's only one possible way I can react to it. Yeah? But somehow this object by its power evokes only one possible response for me. Well, that way of thinking actually imprisons us because it makes us feel like we have no choice in what we feel and what we experience. And that's not the case at all. Because what's going on is, you know, there's a perception of an object by one of, you know, our senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, okay? And then the mind starts making a story about it. The mind pays attention to this object, often in an inappropriate way. And so we project beauty on it that it doesn't really have. We project negativity on it that it doesn't really have. But we don't realize that we're the one projecting this stuff onto the object. And instead we think that it's like that from its own side. And so that's why we feel our reaction to it is the only possible reaction, because the object exists inherently in the way that it appears to our senses. But it doesn't. Because we're just getting color and shape and sound, but then we're making a story about it. Okay? And we paint a picture. Yeah? And so we're painting pictures all the time. Yeah? All the time. We think that we're living in an objectively existent world in which how we experience everything is how it exists. If that were the case, then everybody should like the same thing. Because everything would be objective, and so it would have likable nature in itself. Everybody should like the same food. Everybody should dislike the same people. Yeah. We should all be exactly the same and experience everything exactly the same if we were all in an objectively existent world. But that's not what happens, is it? We all experience things vastly different, you know? And that's because, in part, of what, you know, we are projecting onto something. Mm-hmm. So just even in these, you know how I was talking about sickness, we can project, oh, this is terrible, I'm going to die. Or we can project, oh, this is good, karma's ripening. Depending upon which way we decide to project, that's how we're going to experience it. Okay. Other questions or comments?
Sightseeing.
When you go sightseeing, is it a sense of pleasure? It depends on the individual. Okay. For me, it's usually not. Okay? Because often what sightseeing buses take you to see, I find quite boring. But other times, you know, if you take me to see some temples, then sightseeing is interesting. But then other people would find that boring. They would much rather go shopping. Okay, so you're saying, you know, if we take this thing of rejoicing when negative karma ripens, we could really find ourselves in a pinch because, you know, negative karma keeps ripening, and we keep rejoicing, and then more negative karma keeps ripening. Okay. Actually, my teacher would go, fantastic. That's so good. Okay. So one thing I think that's very important is we tend to give inappropriate attention to the things that aren't going the way we want them to go. Okay? The things that are going the way we want them to go, we take for granted and we want more. Okay? So today, I'm sure all of us could find at least 10 things to complain about what happened today. Okay? You want to hear my day? But, you know, I mean, without any ease, I'm sure we could easily at least list 10 things that happened today the way we didn't want them to happen. 10 ways in which we experience suffering, you know? But look at us. I mean, we ate today. We have a home to live in. We have people who care about us. We're living in a peaceful country. Yeah. We have friends. We have an education. We have a job. Okay. How many things are going well for us in our lives? A lot of things are going well. Do we pay attention to those? No, we just ignore them and take them for granted. Okay? So I think at any particular moment, you know, when we really look at our lives, there's so many things that are going well. And when we only pay attention to the things that happen the way we don't want them to happen, we can make ourselves so depressed and discouraged. But that's our mind making us depressed and discouraged, not the situation. Okay. Whereas if we look at life with a different attitude and really see all the good things that we have, okay. For example, even if you're sick with a terminal disease, okay, to think, wow, you know, I'm receiving medical care. How fortunate I am. Or there's a hospital I can go to. I'm not in a ditch somewhere. How fortunate I am. There's people taking care of me. I have access to modern medicine. You know, even if you're sick, when you look at your situation, we have so much good karma ripening at the same time. So that's why, you remember at the beginning of this session, I said to think about the kindness we've received from others. That's why that meditation's so important, you know, because when we do it, we really shift the way we look at things. You know? And we see that there's so much goodness around us. You know? Then when we see things that way, okay, I have a little bit of suffering. It's manageable. It's okay. I can endure it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question is, in terms of parenting, where's the line between guiding and shaping and being responsible for your child and controlling them? Okay, I think the line lies somewhere in our motivation. Okay, when we see the child as part of us, you know, as an extension of us, that's when I think the controlling mind jumps in. Because we have too much ego attachment to this child. So we want to make them what we've never been. Yeah? We want to make them perfect. We aren't perfect. You know, parents, we aren't perfect. Let's make this kid perfect. Yeah? They're young, moldable. Let's make them into what we were never able to become. You know, let's give them everything we never had, even if they don't want it. Yeah? So, you know, I think when our ego's too identified with the child, that, you know, there's not such a clear distinction between what is me and what is this other living being, that then there's a lot of controlling that comes in. But when you see that the child is their own unique person that came into this life with karma and everything else from a previous life. They have their own Buddha nature. Then you're kind of like a steward, you know, and your role is to guide and to shape, but you've got to see what the tendencies of the child are and what the talents of the child are. No? Because your child might be good in English, or let's say your child's good in music, but you want your child to be good in math. So you say, forget it, forget music, you've got to do math, you've got to do math, you've got to do math. Oh, you idiot kid, you didn't do your arithmetic right, you can't do anything right. I'm going to have a tutor and you've got to, you know, really do your math. And, oh, what are the neighbors going to say? And you did so poor on your test, primary one, you know, and you got 50% on your test. You're a failure for your whole life. Oh, my goodness, you know. I mean, just a little kid. So, you know, and it's just math. Maybe your kid is a musical genius. Yeah. So, you know, they learn some math. Even if they don't, you know, get excellent marks in math, you know, the world goes on. Yeah. So you find out what your child is good in. You know, what they excel in, what their own gifts are, and you nurture those. I mean, you might have a baby Mozart there, but you're trying to make them into an Einstein, and they're never going to be one. But if, you know, if you let them be a Mozart, okay? And even if they aren't Einstein or Mozart, who cares, you know? They have some unique talent, which is apparent, you know, if you can nurture and bring out. I think parenting is probably one of the hardest skills people ever do, the one you're least trained for. Yeah? Yeah, in the back. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, okay? Oh, I think you have a lot of sympathy. Okay, so when we wake up and we feel stressed, yeah, and to the point where you just don't even want to wake up because it's just one big ball of stress, what do you do? I think we really have to simplify our life, and I think we have to simplify our society. And I think as modern societies, we're going way, way, way overboard in what we expect out of people. And I think employers expect way too much, you know, and put too much pressure on their employees. And why do the employers feel so much pressure? Because of greed. Isn't it? Everybody wants to make more money. So they feel pressure to make more money, so they pressurize their employees. And then everybody's stressed out. You make a ton of money, but nobody can enjoy it because they're all too stressed. You know? That's another one of our stupid things that we as human beings do. I have a friend in the U.S. who's a doctor. Sometimes when people come to see him, he prescribes only 8 hours of work a day. Seriously! You know, he has to do... Because you know, it affects people's health when they overwork. And it affects the family. And it's just, it's no good. So I think as a society, I mean, I remember when I was little, they were talking all of this stuff about mechanization and how much leisure time we're going to have in the future. Yeah, because machines will do everything. Well, people have much less leisure time than I was a little kid. Because we've just developed so much greed of wanting to, you know, more and better and more and better. We've got to build the economy. We've got to do this. And it's not bringing any more happiness because we think all the happiness is coming from the money. But like I said, we're all too stressed out to enjoy the material benefits that we're getting from working so hard. So I think as a society, we need to slow down. And as individuals in a society, You know, even if the society isn't slowing down, you have to be very clear about what you're willing to do and what you're not. You know, and if your employer is asking you to work hours that you know are going to harm your family life, harm your mental health, harm your physical health, well, maybe it's time to look for another job. And you're going to go, oh, look for another job. You know? Well, why not? You know, do you want to stay and work in a job that makes you so stressed for the next 30 years? You might die in 10 because you're so stressed. No? And then you're going to, oh, I can't work at another job. I won't have as much money. Well, so what? Well, then people won't respect me if I don't have as much money. Well, so what? Well, then I won't be happy. You know? Well, you mean all your happiness depends on people, what people think about you? That's the sole cause of your happiness, is what other people think about you? Then something's really wrong, you know, really wrong. If the only way you get happiness is, you know, by preventing other people from thinking bad about you, that's no kind of life. Yeah? So I think sometimes just learning to be satisfied with less. Yeah? Okay, I don't have a Mercedes Benz. That's great, then you don't have to pay the repair bills on the Mercedes. You are free from Mercedes Benz hell. You know? Think about it, because whatever you possess, there's a corresponding hell realm to it. Isn't there? Yeah, have you ever been in computer hell? We've all been in computer hell, haven't we? You know, oh, computer hell. You know, but those of us who don't own cars, then we don't have car hell. So sometimes just simplifying your life, knowing that you can be just as happy without having so much stuff, and that even if you don't have as much as everybody else does, so what? Maybe you're happier. Hmm? Maybe you're happier. Maybe all those people who make a lot of money, you know, are spending it on sending their children to therapists because their children don't feel loved because the parents are never there at home. Okay? So I think, you know, figure out what's really important to you in life and then do that. Because, you know, look at it this way. When you're on your deathbed and dying, okay, when somebody's, not you or anybody, it could be you, somebody else on their deathbed and dying, what kind of regrets do people usually have when they're dying? That maybe they did something cruel to somebody they love, or maybe they didn't appreciate somebody else enough, or maybe they didn't practice the Dharma. Those kind of regrets, the kind of regrets people have when they die. Does anybody ever regret when they're on their deathbed saying, I should have worked more overtime? You know, are you kidding? Nobody regrets that. Nobody's going to lie on their deathbed and say, I should have worked more overtime. No, that's insanity. Absolute insanity. Okay. So why are we making ourselves so stressed out and neurotic right now? Now, I think we really have to think about what's important and live from our heart. And I think that's what we should be looking at. Yeah. Because, you know, to have a happy life, we have to have ethical discipline, we have to have a kind heart. No? So those things, those kind of qualities create happiness now, they create the cause of happiness in future lives. Okay, but greed for money and possessions creates dissatisfaction and stress now and a ton of negative karma for our future lives. Okay. So she's referring to the story I told about the monk who was afraid of losing his compassion. And what did he do at that moment to not lose his compassion? She's saying we so often are in that situation where we're compassionate, we're great, and then it's like, I've had enough! Stop it! Isn't it? Yeah, we've all gone through that. So, I think it's just the thing of constantly familiarizing ourselves with a compassionate heart. Constantly just coming back to that. Constantly letting go, you know. I mean, in that monk's case, he had people who were actually trying to harm him. What I find in my life is I'm often getting angry at people who are trying to help me. You know, people who care about me, who are trying to do things to help me. And I get angry because I want them to do it faster, or they want them to do it at another time, or something. I mean, but these are so often, I don't know, think about it in terms of your own life. Do you ever get angry at somebody who's actually has a good intention towards you and is trying to help you, but they're just not doing it the way you want them to? You know, but it's so silly, isn't it? Because they're wishing us well. And we're blocking out that whole possible exchange of affection by our mind making up some kind of silly story. So I think, you know, when we can catch ourselves like that and then let go of the story, okay? So this requires a lot of meditation, you know, practicing this kind of thing in our daily meditation, familiarizing ourselves with it again and again and again. I find the expression that we have, mother sentient being, very, you know, very important, because that's saying that, you know, we've all had infinite beginningless rebirths. And so every sentient being has been our mother at one time or another, which means every sentient being has been kind to us, you know, has given birth to us, who's taken care of us when we've been an infant, has taught us, has protected us, you know. And when we think of this kind of kindness, and then you go around and you think of all these people one time or another with my mother, and I had this very close, you know, relationship with them, then it makes you not see them so much in how they're appearing this life, but it gives you a bigger picture of who they are. And so they say, like for an example, if when you were very young, if you were separated from your mother, and then 30 years later, you were walking down the street, and you saw your mother as a beggar in the street, yeah? Would you treat her as, would you just keep on walking? No, you would stop there and you go, this is my mother, you know, come home with me, I'm going to take care of you. Yeah, there would be this instant feeling of closeness and affection. So in a similar way, you know, somebody may have been our mother and been kind to us in a previous life. We've been separated for some time because we've died and been reborn and died and been reborn. But still that doesn't change the fact that that being was once our mother and was once kind to us. So if we can train our mind to see everybody as having been our mother and having been very kind to us in that way, then it gives us the ability to really respect them and appreciate them. And then even if there's somebody who maybe we don't like particularly this life, we can see, well, maybe we don't like them because at this particular moment their minds are overwhelmed by negativity or their minds are overwhelmed by the results of their own karma. So rather than hold that against them, to have a sense of compassion, saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if they were free from that suffering? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so she's saying everything I'm saying to takes practice. What do you do in that situation? You rely on the practice you did before. And if you didn't do any practice before, it's your responsibility. Okay? There is no instant push button method to, you know, for, to go around the having to practice, where at that very moment, you know, I can sleep late, I can do everything I want, and at that very moment, suddenly the Dharma is going to come in my mind and I'm not going to be angry. Forget it. You know, we're creatures of habit. So we have to, the word meditation is the same word as to habituate and familiarize. So we have to make new habits in our mind. And we're the ones who've got to do that. You can't take a pill. Yeah, you can't pay somebody to do it for you. You can make a lot of money, but you can't pay somebody else to practice patience for you. Okay, we have to do it ourselves. So let's sit quietly now. A little final concluding meditation. Okay. So in this meditation, reflect on some of the things that we talked about today, and reflect on some of on them in such a way that you can apply them to your life and apply them to what's happening to you. So it'll just be a short meditation, but really use it to review the teachings and apply it to your life. Then let's rejoice that we were able to spend the evening together thinking about the Dharma, transforming our minds. Let's rejoice at all the positive potential we created as individuals and as a group. Let's rejoice at all the goodness in the world, all the merit or positive potential of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Arhats. And then let's dedicate all that good energy, the positive potential, and send it out into the universe, together with our prayers that all beings be relieved of whatever physical or mental or emotional suffering they have, that all beings have the possibility to encounter the Buddha's precious teachings, to listen, reflect, and meditate on them. Let's dedicate so that we continuously help each other in this and all future lives, so as we progress along the path, and that we act as good Dharma friends and supports to all other living beings that we encounter in whatever realms we're reborn in, from now until enlightenment. And let's dedicate so that each living being may quickly become a fully enlightened Buddha.